October 31st, 1981. New York City. The bodies of 39-year-old Ronald Sisman and 20-year-old Elizabeth Platzman are discovered inside Ron's apartment. Both victims have been shot to death, execution style, and since the apartment has been ransacked, there is speculation that the crime might be drug-related. However, convicted Son of Sam serial killer David Berkowitz eventually shares information that Ron and Liz were killed by associates of his who were members of a satanic cult, but this is never substantiated, and the murders continue to remain unsolved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Werder, and since we are currently in the month of October, we're going to be covering an unsolved double homicide which took place around Halloween, the 1981 murders of Ronald Sisman and Elizabeth Platzman. As you probably know, it's always been my yearly tradition to spend the last few weeks of October covering mysteries which have some sort of Halloween slant to them, and before I entered the world of podcasting, I wrote a bunch of true crime articles for listverse.com. On October 31st, 2014, I published an article there titled 10 Creepy Unsolved Mysteries That Happened on Halloween, and every year around this time, it seems like this list gets reworked by various websites and YouTube videos, which all usually feature the same cases, but make no mistake about it, my article is the original. I've since done Trail Went Cold episodes about quite a few of the cases on that list, but what I haven't talked about until now are the murders of Ronald Sisman and Elizabeth Platzman. The main reason I held off on it is because researching this story will take you down a number of different rabbit holes, and it can become hard to differentiate fact from fiction. Ron and Liz were both found shot to death, execution style, inside Ron's apartment, and while the police initially suspected that the crime was drug-related, it would eventually be linked to one of the most infamous serial killers of all time, the Son of Sam, David Berkowitz. While Berkowitz has been incarcerated for the past four decades, one prominent conspiracy theory is that he did not commit all the Son of Sam murders alone, and was just one member of a satanic cult which was responsible for numerous crimes. While the phrase satanic cult might sound incredibly outdated, this theory was actually presented in a four-part documentary series titled The Sons of Sam, A Descent into Darkness, which was released on Netflix in May of 2021. This series briefly made reference to the murders of Ronald Sisman and Elizabeth Platzman, and I'll state right up front that some of the rumors surrounding this case are pretty out there, such as the two victims being killed in order to recover a snuff film of one of the Son of Sam murders. But regardless of whether you put any credence into these conspiracy theories, that doesn't change the fact that we still have an unsolved cold case in which two victims lost their lives, so it's definitely worthy of discussion on a Trail Went Cold episode, and perhaps we may even clear up some of the misinformation surrounding this case. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. I also just wanted to mention that we're now getting close to attaining 500 Patreon subscribers, and if we manage to attain our milestone by the end of October, we'll be providing an additional extra special bonus for all of our patrons in November. In addition, I need to announce that this coming Saturday, October the 21st, we'll be holding one of our annual Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathons, in which I screen classic segments from the show. Of course, given the time of year, we're going to be screening some special Halloween-themed segments, and you can watch them and chat with myself and your fellow listeners. It's taking place at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and if you'd like to join us, you can find the link to our screening room in our show notes and pinned to the top of our social media pages. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the murders of Ronald Sisman and Elizabeth Platzman. Our story begins on Halloween night in New York City in 1981. Our two central figures are 39-year-old Ronald Sisman, who goes by the name Ron, and 20-year-old Elizabeth Platzman, who goes by Liz. Ron originally hails from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, and works as a freelance photographer who operates a pair of photography businesses and lives in a duplex apartment which takes up both the third and fourth floors of a four-story brownstone on West 22nd Street in Manhattan's Chelsea neighborhood near Greenwich Village. Liz has spent most of her life living with her family in an affluent neighborhood in the village of Roslyn on Long Island, and is currently a junior at Smith College, a private, liberal arts, all-women's college in Northampton, Massachusetts. She is an honor student majoring in art history, and described by everyone who knows her as a talented and intelligent artist, as well as a very kind and compassionate person. Now, many of the sources you'll find out there state that Ron and Liz were boyfriend and girlfriend, but I'm not entirely sure this was the case. They were originally introduced to each other by Lynn's cousin, Hillary Sklar, who had been Ron's next-door neighbor, and Hillary's husband was partners with Ron in two photography studios. Some of the original press coverage from this time period state that Ron and Liz had started dating, but I don't know if this was substantiated, and Hillary was quoted as saying that they had a quote-unquote honest, upright friendship. But even if they had started dating, I doubt it was a serious relationship, since they had only known each other for around 2 months or so, and Liz spent much of that time living over 150 miles away in Northampton. On the evening of Thursday, October the 29th, Liz left the campus at Smith College and told some of her fellow students that she was making the nearly 3-hour trip back to New York. After she arrived in Manhattan, Liz was planning to spend the night with a relative before taking the train to visit her family in Roslyn the following day. From reading the original press coverage, I'm not sure if investigators were able to determine who exactly drove Liz to New York, but it's possible that she may have posted a notice on a rideshare board on campus, as students often use this method to arrange transportation. Whatever the case, by the morning of Saturday, October the 31st, Liz had still not arrived home in Roslyn, so her concerned parents called Smith College to try and see if anyone knew where she was. Well, later that same evening at around 7:40 p.m., some of Ron's neighbors became concerned since they were unable to reach him on the phone, so they decided to check his apartment. When they arrived at his third floor door, they discovered it was unlocked and decided to walk inside, but soon made a shocking discovery. The bodies of Ron and Liz were both lying on the floor and the walls were spattered with blood, so the New York Police Department was summoned to the scene. It would turn out that Ron had been shot a total of 4 times, while Liz was shot 3 times, and they each received 1 gunshot wound to the back of the head at close range, execution style. Since no one had reported hearing any gunshots, police suspected that whoever killed Ron and Liz had used silencers on their firearms. While no one could be certain when exactly the couple was murdered, they may have been dead inside the apartment for at least a day before they were found. The place was ransacked, and while police were unable to determine if anything was stolen, the condition of the apartment suggested that the responsible parties were looking for something specific. Investigators suspected that at least 2 perpetrators were involved, and since there were no signs of forced entry, Ron may have known his killer or killers and willingly let them inside before he and Liz were shot. I've been unable to find any conclusive information about when or why Liz showed up at Ron's apartment, as it's possible that the relative she was planning to spend the night with was out, so she went to see Ron instead. It was also reported that Liz had been planning to shoot a photographic essay for a student magazine at some point in the future, but if she did not have the necessary equipment she needed, she may have visited Ron in order to borrow it from him or find out how to obtain it. It's also been reported that both victims were wearing coats when their bodies were found, which suggests that they may have been in the midst of leaving or returning to the apartment when they were shot. It would turn out that Ron had recently applied for a target permit for a 25 caliber gun and a permit to keep this weapon at home, and while both these permits had been approved, they had not yet been processed at the time of his death. Ron apparently wanted to obtain a weapon because he believed that someone had been trying to break into his apartment. The building superintendent described Ron as a secretive person who often stayed up late and had visitors go in and out of his apartment for only a few minutes at a time. For this reason, some of Ron's neighbors expressed their belief that he may have been selling drugs from his apartment in order to supplement his income. Indeed, 2 ounces of white powder believed to be cocaine were found at the scene, leading to speculation that the crime may have been drug-related. Now, I'll go into more detail about this later on in the episode, but some of the initial reporting on this case by outlets such as the New York Post were heavily sensationalized, and Liz's friends and family felt that it painted an inaccurate picture of her character. Her loved ones maintained that Liz was a very honest person who never would have involved herself in anything illegal, so even if the rumors about Ron dealing drugs were true, Liz likely didn't know anything about it. Indeed, the NYPD were inclined to believe that Ron was always the intended target, and Liz was a completely innocent victim who was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. It also turned out that Ron was connected to a major scandal, which had garnered a lot of media attention in New York over the preceding year, and involved an actress named Melanie Holler. In 1977, Melanie had received a major break when she was cast in the role of Angie Grabowski, a new character that was introduced in the middle of the third season on the hit television sitcom Welcome Back, Kotter. Melanie appeared in 7 episodes, but her character was eliminated after the season came to a close, and by 1980, she had failed to secure any more prominent roles, and her acting career was floundering. However, Melanie did appear nude in an issue of Playboy magazine, which was released in March of that year, and Ron Sisman happened to be a family friend who shot a pictorial portfolio for her. I'm not entirely sure how accurate this next point is, but it's been reported that Ron introduced Melanie to Roy Radin, a wealthy and prominent show business promoter who had the potential to help Melanie revive her acting career. For the past decade, Radin's company, Roy Radin Enterprises, had been promoting vaudeville shows and music nostalgia tours, but he was hoping to break into the film business and become a producer. Around this time period, Melanie was dating a businessman named Robert McKeague, and he invited her to accompany him to a weekend dinner party, which was being held on April the 11th at Roy Radin's 72-room beachfront mansion in the town of Southampton on Long Island. However, during the early morning hours of April the 13th, a bloodied and unconscious Melanie was found on a commuter train heading towards Manhattan. After the police were notified, Melanie told them that after she arrived at the party, she became the victim of an assault where both Radin and McKeague proceeded to drug, beat, and rape her while 2 women held her down and the entire incident was filmed. Afterward, McKeague drove Melanie to the Long Island Railroad Station in Southampton and dumped her on the train to Manhattan. When Radin was questioned about this, he acknowledged that some sadomasochistic sex games had taken place at the party, but maintained that Melanie participated in them willingly, and everything that happened to her was consensual. A search of Radin's mansion uncovered drugs and an unregistered firearm, so Radin was charged with menacing, criminal possession of LSD and cocaine, and illegal possession of a handgun. But in November of that year, Radin agreed to a plea deal, in which he would plead guilty to the handgun charge in exchange for the other 2 charges being dropped, and he received a sentence of 3 years probation and a $1,000 fine. A few months later, Robert McKeague pled guilty to second-degree assault for his role in the attack on Melanie, but he only received a 30-day jail sentence, while the 2 women who held Melanie down received probation. Within the next few years, Roy Radin would make headlines again, when he became involved in the financing of a film called The Cotton Club and wound up getting murdered over it, but I'll go into more details about that later on in this episode. Anyway, even if Ronald Sisman had introduced Melanie Holler to Roy Radin, he did not attend Radin's party and had no actual involvement in the assault, though his name wound up being published in the papers just 1 month after the attack took place. On May the 16th, 1980, after Melanie was taken to Mount Sinai Hospital, she claimed that she visited Ron's apartment, and he proceeded to inject her with drugs against her will. When questioned about this, Ron acknowledged that Melanie had come to see him, in order to look for some scrapbook pictures, but wound up coming across some newspaper clippings about the attack at Raiden's party. Ron then said that Melanie started acting paranoid and hysterical, and proceeded to lock herself in the bathroom while yelling, quote, "They're here, they're going to kill me." In response, Ron gave Melanie some legally prescribed Valium that she was carrying around in her purse in order to calm her down, and then had one of Melanie's female friends drive her to Mount Sinai. In the end, no charges were ever filed against Ron, as Melanie did not make a formal complaint and stopped cooperating with investigators. At one point, Ron did testify at a grand jury hearing which was investigating Melanie's assault, but when Ron and Liz were murdered over 1 year later, investigators almost immediately discounted the possibility that the two cases were connected. In fact, Raiden's attorney put out a statement that his client did not even know Ron, though as we're going to discuss momentarily, there is a conspiracy theory that says otherwise. And I suppose now would be a good time to start talking about an infamous serial killer who would be unexpectedly linked to this crime. The son of Sam, David Berkowitz. Now, I'm sure most of you already know this story, but to recap, from the summer of 1976 until 1977, New York City was terrorized by a series of crimes in which a total of 6 people were shot to death while 7 others were seriously wounded. The killer sent out some taunting, anonymous letters to the police and the press, identifying himself as the son of Sam, until he was eventually identified as 24-year-old David Berkowitz. Following his arrest, Berkowitz confessed to all the shootings, and initially claimed that he committed the crimes on the orders of a demon who had possessed a dog owned by a neighbor named Sam. After pleading guilty to all of his crimes, Berkowitz received 6 consecutive life sentences, and he is still incarcerated to this day. Well, the Son of Sam case has always been surrounded by conspiracy theories that Berkowitz did not commit all the shootings alone and was a member of a satanic cult. Berkowitz alleged that multiple people were responsible for these murders, and he wound up being the fall guy. The entire theory is way too extensive to detail here, but a years-long investigation was conducted into these claims by journalist Maury Terry, who published his findings in his 1987 book, The Ultimate Evil, The Truth About the Cult Murders, Son of Sam and Beyond. No conclusive evidence has ever been found that anyone besides Berkowitz was involved in the Son of Sam shootings, but even though Maury Terry has since passed away, his theory continues to be the subject of debate and would be extensively covered in the 4-part documentary series, The Sons of Sam, A Descent into Darkness, which was directed by Joshua Zeman and dropped on Netflix in May of 2021. Now, obviously, Berkowitz was already in prison by the time Ronald Sisman and Elizabeth Platzman were killed, but Maury Terry would allege that their deaths were connected to the same cult who was responsible for the Son of Sam shootings. According to Terry, this theory came about when he was contacted by an informant whom he referred to only as Vinny, who had been incarcerated at the Attica Correctional Facility alongside Berkowitz. Vinny claimed that in mid-October of 1981, Berkowitz had been telling people that the cult he was involved with were planning a ritualistic murder, which would take place in or near Greenwich Village on Halloween of that year. Berkowitz allegedly described it as a quote-unquote inside house cleaning thing, and said it would combine human sacrifice with the elimination of a perceived weak link. He specifically mentioned that a male and female would get their heads shot off before evidence was removed from the scene. Then he said that Berkowitz referred to the male victim by such names as Ronald, Sisek, or Sissy Spacek, which he figured was a code name for Ronald Sisman, and of course, Berkowitz had apparently started talking about this only a few weeks before Ron and Liz were murdered. Now, I'll add the disclaimer that you need to take the next pieces of information I'm about to share with you with a huge grain of salt, but according to Vinny, Berkowitz had said that Ron was involved in a drug and porno enterprise run by Roy Raiden, who was also a member of their cult. Vinny even shared this quote to describe the cult, stating, quote, "Satanism is a byproduct, the real motivation for the leaders is drugs," end quote. While Ron was not an official member of the cult per se, he handled a lot of the drug dealing on behalf of Raiden, and due to his photography skills, he would be hired by the cult to shoot a snuff film of one of their murders. The last Son of Sam shooting occurred during the early morning hours of July the 31st, 1977, when a couple named Stacy Moskowitz and Robert Violante were making out inside their car near a park in the Bath Beach neighborhood. Berkowitz approached the vehicle and fired 4 shots into the couple, and while Stacy was killed, Robert wound up surviving the attack, though he lost his left eye. Berkowitz claimed that Ron and two other cult members used a video camera to film the shooting from a nearby parked van. The plan was to sell the snuff film to the highest bidder, but Ron apparently made a copy of it, and by 1981, he was supposedly facing potential drug charges for selling cocaine. The story goes that Ron made a copy of the snuff film and was planning to turn it over to the authorities in exchange for immunity on the drug charges, so the cult determined that he was a liability and decided that he needed to be eliminated. They then showed up at Ron's apartment on or around Halloween and killed both him and Liz and proceeded to ransack the place until they retrieved the snuff film. Berkowitz claimed that he and one of his fellow cult members, Michael Carr, had visited Ron's apartment on a previous occasion years earlier in order to buy drugs. When he shared this story, Berkowitz supposedly provided an accurate description of the apartment, which included mention of an ornate chandelier hanging from the ceiling, so Maury Terry became convinced that Berkowitz had been there and had legitimate inside knowledge of this crime. Berkowitz's claims would later be corroborated by a career criminal named Jesse Turner, who wound up being incarcerated at the Federal Correctional Institution in Talladega, Alabama, for bank robbery. Turner claimed that he had been enlisted with the task of recovering the snuff film, so he recruited two gunmen to kill Ron and Liz and retrieve the film from Ron's apartment. In 1996, detectives from the NYPD did investigate these claims and questioned the two unnamed gunmen, but even though they both reportedly failed polygraph tests, there was not enough evidence to make an arrest. According to Terry, the new investigation ground to a dead halt when high-ranking officials from the NYPD stepped in and shut it down. He always theorized that they did not want Ron and Liz's murders to be solved because it could potentially destroy their narrative that David Berkowitz was solely responsible for the Son of Sam shootings. But once again, there has never been any conclusive evidence found that Berkowitz was a member of a satanic cult who orchestrated the Son of Sam murders, or that those crimes have any connection at all to this case. So after four decades, there's still no answers about who is actually responsible for killing Ronald Sisman and Elizabeth Platzman. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So one of the biggest obstacles I faced when putting together this episode was avoiding the urge to spend too much time focusing on the conspiracy theory that multiple people besides David Berkowitz were involved in the Son of Sam murders. After all, the primary topic of this episode are the unsolved murders of Ronald Sisman and Elizabeth Platzman, and we don't even know if they have any connection to Son of Sam at all, though many of the sources you'll find link these two cases together. I'm sure it won't surprise you to learn that I first became familiar with the Son of Sam satanic cult conspiracy theory when it was featured on Unsolved Mysteries in November of 1988, and since I was only 10 years old at the time, I totally bought this whole theory hook, line, and sinker. Hell, even as I got older and learned more about the concept of satanic panic, I still wouldn't discount this theory and consider the Son of Sam murders to be one of the few cases where the idea of a satanic cult was not completely implausible. I still consider the Unsolved Mysteries segment about Son of Sam to be one of my all-time favorites, as the production values are first rate. But I also have to acknowledge that it's definitely a product of its time, as reenactments of people in hoods and robes doing chants while holding satanic ceremonies at New York City parks in the middle of the night are definitely a time capsule of the era of satanic panic. On the other side of the coin, the aforementioned Netflix documentary series, The Sons of Sam, A Descendant in Darkness, came out just 2 years ago, and watching it at the time, all I could say to myself was, wow, are they really still pushing satanic panic angles in 2021? To be fair, the last episode of the series does put a lot of focus on the fact that Maury Terry's never-ending investigation into this so-called cult did not seem to lead anywhere, and his physical and mental health really deteriorated before he passed away in December of 2015. The thing with investigating conspiracy theories is that they can send you so far down a rabbit hole that you're unable to get back out, and you either lose your grip on reality, or face the horrifying realization that you've invested so much time and energy into something which will never have a real payoff. I think the big turning point for Terry occurred in November of 1993, when David Berkowitz agreed to do a sit-down interview with him from prison, which aired on a three-night special of the TV show Inside Edition. They hyped it up as if Berkowitz was finally going to share everything he knew and blow the entire lid off the satanic cult conspiracy, but it appeared that Terry was asking him leading questions and Berkowitz was providing evasive answers, which led skeptics to suspect that this whole angle was pure fantasy. After all these years, I now think that the most logical explanation is that David Berkowitz committed all the Son of Sam murders on his own, and even if there were other people involved, I don't believe there was a massive conspiracy involving a satanic cult. I will say that I did appreciate how the Netflix documentary spent some time talking about the Sisman-Plattsman murders, as this is not a case which has gotten a lot of exposure in the mainstream media for many years. And even if you discount the idea of the case having any connection to Son of Sam, that doesn't change the fact that two victims were shot to death and no one has ever faced justice for this crime. While certain details have been exaggerated over the years, it is a confirmed fact that Ron and Liz were both shot multiple times, execution style, and someone did ransack Ron's apartment in an apparent attempt to find something. Now, the Son of Sam angle did not enter the equation until years after the crime took place, but the press already picked up on the fact that Ron had a connection to the alleged assault that Melanie Holler experienced at the hands of Roy Radin. Even though investigators immediately discounted any link between the two cases, it sounds like Maury Terry eventually ran with this angle, as Berkowitz told him that Radin was involved with his cult. He also believed that Radin was the one who commissioned the shooting of the so-called snuff film for one of the Son of Sam murders, and if there's another moral panic which defines the 1970s and 80s as much as Satanism, it's snuff films. But before we talk any more about that topic, I have to discuss Roy Radin's murder which took place a few years later, and I have to admit that it was quite bizarre. On May the 13th, 1983, Radin went missing while traveling to a conference in Beverly Hills, California, and a few weeks later, his remains were discovered in a canyon in Angeles National Park near the unincorporated community of Gorman. Radin, who was 33 years old, had been shot in the head multiple times in what appeared to be a contract hit. The responsible party had even gone to the trouble of setting off a stick of dynamite in his mouth in order to blow off his face and make identification more difficult. Well, when Maury Terry released his book, The Ultimate Evil, in 1987, he outlined a theory in which the satanic cult killed Radin due to disagreements over business dealings, which seemed to take the investigators on Radin's case by complete surprise, as they claimed they had not uncovered anything to lead them in that direction. Well, in October of 1988, just 1 year after The Ultimate Evil came out, four suspects would finally be arrested for their roles in Radin's murder, which apparently had nothing to do with the Son of Sam case. This particular crime became known as the Cotton Club murder, and I won't spend too much time talking about it, since you could probably do an entire podcast series on this story. The Cotton Club is the title of a movie which came out in 1984 and told a fictionalized story about the criminal activities which took place at a Harlem jazz club of the same name during the 1930s. The film was directed by Francis Ford Coppola and starred such actors as Richard Gere, Gregory Hines, and Diane Lane, and long story short, it had quite a troubled production history and took nearly 5 years to make. Well, Roy Radin was hoping to break into Hollywood and initially became one of the financial backers of the Cotton Club, though he was killed before the movie was completed. It would turn out that the mastermind behind the murder plot was Radin's girlfriend, Karen Greenberger, aka Lainey Jacobs, who had introduced Radin to the film's producer, Robert Evans, and feared that Radin was secretly negotiating a deal in order to cut her out from receiving any of the movie's profits. Greenberger slash Jacobs was also a major cocaine dealer, and the three men that she hired to kill Radin, William Mentzer, Alex Marty, and Robert Lowe, all worked as her bodyguards. These four individuals were tried and convicted for their roles in the crime, but of course, this hasn't stopped conspiracy theorists from trying to link it to the Son of Sam case. Berkowitz claimed that one of Raiden's killers, William Mentzer, was a former associate of Charles Manson, and when he joined his cult, he became a very powerful individual, and they gave him the nickname Manson II. In fact, Berkowitz alleged that Mentzer was the one who decided that he should single-handedly take the fall for the Son of Sam murders. The Ultimate Evil spends a lot of time exploring the theory that Mentzer and the cult were responsible for the murder of 19-year-old Arliss Perry, who was found murdered inside Stanford Memorial Church on the grounds of Stanford University in California on October 12, 1974. The crime was a particularly brutal one, as she had been stabbed with an ice pick and an altar candle was inserted into her vagina, so I can understand why one might believe that this was a ritualistic murder committed by a satanic cult. But the case was finally solved in June of 2018, when DNA testing linked the crime to Stephen Crawford, the Stanford police officer who had originally reported finding Arliss's body. The Netflix documentary series concludes with actual body cam footage of the police showing up at Crawford's apartment with a warrant, but he wound up fatally shooting himself before he could be arrested. They also reveal that Crawford had a copy of The Ultimate Evil in his possessions at the time of his death, which I think is intended to be a big aha moment, but I don't believe that proves he was a member of any cult. The book spent a lot of time analyzing a murder that Crawford had committed, so why wouldn't he own a copy? Hell, he may have been feeling immense satisfaction over the fact that it was exploring a completely false theory which leaned away from him. I have to confess that I never actually read The Ultimate Evil until I started researching this episode, and while I'm sure I would have found the book fascinating if I read it several years ago, it has not aged well and comes across as a sensationalized product of its time. And I think the resolution of the Arliss Perry murder has put another nail in the coffin for the Son of Sam satanic cult theory. So now that the Roy Raiden and Arliss Perry murders have been solved, and we know the full truth behind them, we have to explore and possibly debunk any possible link between Son of Sam and the murders of Ronald Sisman and Elizabeth Plattsman. The initial driving force behind this theory is the mysterious prison informant known only as Vinny, who got in touch with Maury Terry and told him that Berkowitz had shared incriminating details about the crime while they were incarcerated at the Attica Correctional Institution. As far as I can tell, Terry never revealed Vinny's real identity publicly, and given that jailhouse informants have a tendency to lie about things all the time, you have to take anything Vinny said with a huge grain of salt. But to be fair, Berkowitz did later corroborate many of Vinny's claims, so maybe Vinny was actually telling the truth, and Berkowitz was the one who was feeding him nonsense. The theory about Ron and Liz's murders being connected to Son of Sam was never shared by the media until Terry discussed it in The Ultimate Evil, but that's not to say this crime did not have its fair share of sensationalistic reporting at the time it originally occurred, mostly by the New York Post. At one point, they read a headline which read, quote, "Preppy, Porn King Slain," and described Lon's apartment as a, quote-unquote, sex lair, where he would supposedly take compromising photos of people in order to blackmail them. They also referred to Liz and Ron as, quote-unquote, Beauty and the Beast, and alleged that Ron was heavily involved in drugs and pornography while Liz was living some sort of double life. While the Post would receive heavy criticism from Liz's family and friends, as well as other New York media outlets, who said that they were heavily embellishing and exaggerating many details and practically performing character assassination on both victims. Ron was definitely a professional photographer, but even though the NYPD said that they found thousands of photos in his apartment of young women who had posed for him, there was no actual pornographic material. However, I do think the stories about Ron dealing drugs out of his apartment were most likely true, as small traces of what appeared to be cocaine were found at the scene, and the police publicly expressed their belief that the crime was drug-related. But even this detail has been greatly exaggerated, as The Ultimate Evil makes it sound like the cult was involved in a major drug trafficking network which received cocaine from places like Miami and Colombia. In actuality, Ron's neighbors seemed to believe that he was a small-time dealer who mostly provided drugs to his friends. So now let's talk some more about the assault of Melanie Haller, as some of the more conspiracy-minded sources seem to think it somehow has a connection to these murders. While The Ultimate Evil makes it sound like Ron and Roy Raiden ran this major drug and porno enterprise connected to the Son of Sam cult, I honestly don't know if these two men even met each other. While it's been reported in some places that Ron was the one who introduced Melanie to Raiden, I'm not sure that detail is accurate. If you look at the original reporting of this case, it says that it was Robert McKeag, the man Melanie was dating at that time, who decided to take her to Raiden's party. I have zero doubt that Melanie was the victim of a vicious assault at that party, and it's a disgrace that Raiden, McKeag, and everyone else who was involved got off with such light sentences, but that doesn't mean they were members of a satanic cult. The only reason Ron is even connected to these events is because Melanie went to his apartment 1 month later and she accused him of injecting her with drugs against her will. But Ron maintained that Melanie was suffering through a major mental health crisis and he only gave her a legally prescribed Valium she was carrying in order to calm her down. One person who publicly supported Ron's story was Melanie's mother, Myra Holler, who transferred her daughter to a private healthcare facility in Connecticut after this incident took place. Myra told the press that Melanie was experiencing paranoid delusions and had suffered a nervous breakdown, and she expressed her belief that Ron was telling the truth about the Valium, even going so far as to refer to him as a quote-unquote very respectable man. When you discount the Son of Sam conspiracy theories, it really does seem like nothing more than a coincidence that Ron had these tentative connections to Melanie Holler's assault and Roy Raiden's eventual murder. While the original press coverage of this case had comments from numerous people who spoke highly of Elizabeth Plattsman's character and said glowing things about her, we really don't know all that much about Ron as a person. Considering that there was a 19-year age difference between Ron and Liz, it's easy to assume that Ron was this major sleazebag who dragged his innocent, naive young girlfriend into his illegal activities and wound up getting her killed. But like I mentioned earlier, I can't even be 100% certain if Ron and Liz were a couple, or if they were nothing more than friends. Well, we do know that Ron and Liz were first introduced to each other during the summer of 1981, shortly before Liz began her latest semester at Smith College in Northampton. Since the college was 150 miles away from New York, and I'm not sure how much Liz commuted back and forth, it really doesn't sound like they would have had much of an opportunity to develop a serious relationship. However, I don't discount the possibility that Liz did start dating Ron, but just didn't tell many people about it, perhaps because she felt her family wouldn't have approved of the age difference. It's been theorized that the only reason Liz went to Ron's apartment during the last weekend of October is because she needed to obtain some camera equipment for an upcoming photo shoot, but I do get the impression that something else may have been going on. As you recall, Liz left the campus of Smith College on Thursday, October the 29th, and was supposedly planning to spend the night with a relative in Manhattan before taking the train home to see her family in Roslyn the following day. It's never been established why or how Liz wound up at Ron's place, but it was initially theorized that this relative may have been out when she arrived in Manhattan on the evening of the 29th, so she went to see Ron instead. But the alternate explanation is that the so-called relative was just a cover story because Liz was planning to spend the night with Ron and did not want her family knowing that she was involved in a secret romance with an older man. I know that investigators were having trouble establishing how Liz traveled from Northampton to New York to begin with, and while they theorized that she may have obtained a ride by using the campus's rideshare board, part of me wonders if perhaps Ron might have driven to Smith College in order to pick her up. Of course, this is all just speculation on my part, but what does seem clear is that whatever the motive for this crime was, Ron was likely the intended target, and Liz just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and got killed over something she had nothing to do with. Now, I've seen some sources out there which state that Ron and Liz were beaten prior to their murders, but I don't see any mention of this during the original press coverage, so I'm not entirely sure if this is true. The Ultimate Evil also states that Liz's hands were bound behind her back with a cord, another detail which wasn't mentioned in the newspapers, though I will acknowledge that perhaps investigators initially chose to withhold that information from the public. Whatever the case, it was conclusively established that Ron and Liz were both shot multiple times, and each received one execution-style shot to the back of the head at close range. The media reported that none of the other neighbors at the apartment building recalled hearing any gunshots, which is why the police theorized that silencers may have been used. It's also a confirmed fact that Ron's apartment was ransacked, as photos of this were published in the newspapers, so even if you discount all the Son of Sam conspiracy theories, this still seems like a calculated professional crime, and the perpetrators were clearly looking for something. Of course, the story provided by David Berkowitz is that the killers were searching for a copy of a snuff film Ron had shot 4 years earlier of the shooting of Stacy Moskowitz and Robert Violante. This was the final Son of Sam shooting which took place before Berkowitz's arrest, but even though numerous witnesses placed Berkowitz in the neighborhood on the night of the crime, conspiracy theorists have argued that he was only there as an observer and that someone else actually pulled the trigger. Berkowitz claimed that Ron was planning to turn the snuff film over to the authorities in exchange for immunity on pending drug charges, and if footage came out of another individual besides Berkowitz committing one of the Son of Sam murders, it would cause the whole case to be re-examined. Well, it's now officially been 46 years since Berkowitz's arrest, and this so-called snuff film has never popped up in circulation, and I'm sure it won't shock you to hear me say that it probably never existed in the first place. Now, these days, snuff films are pretty much considered to be nothing more than an urban legend. Of course, there are documented cases of people having filmed their murders, but in the pre-internet era of the 1970s and 80s, there was a moral panic that these secret underground distribution networks existed in which innocent victims would be murdered on camera, and these snuff films would then be sold and distributed for the purposes of entertainment. Even though Ron was not considered to be an official member of the Son of Sam cult, the story goes that Roy Radin wanted to utilize his photography skills in order to commission him to shoot a snuff film of one of the Son of Sam murders. If you read The Ultimate Evil, Maury Terry seems to believe this theory, but the evidence is weak at best. For instance, a parked van had been seen in the vicinity of the Moskowitz-Violante shooting, and Ron just happened to own a van in 1977, and his family recalled having him borrowed a Betamax camera during that time period. Terry's theory is that when Ron and Liz were confronted by their killers at the apartment, Ron initially told them that the snuff film was hidden somewhere, like a bus locker, because he figured this information might save his life. The shooters then killed Ron and Liz anyway, but when they discovered that the film was not at the location where Ron said it was, they returned to his apartment at a later time and ransacked the place until they found what they were looking for. Now, the biggest argument which has been pushed forward to support the idea that Berkowitz's snuff film story was credible is that he supposedly told Vinny, the prison informant, about the murders 2 weeks before they took place. According to Vinny, Berkowitz said that a male and female victim would get their head shot off on Halloween near Greenwich Village, and the murder scene would be ransacked so that evidence could be removed. Berkowitz even provided specific details about Ron's apartment, such as his description of a chandelier, to suggest he had been there on a previous occasion. On the surface, it might appear that members of Berkowitz's cult were somehow feeding him information in prison and shared their plans to kill Ron and Liz. However, here's the big flaw in that logic. Berkowitz specifically mentioned a male and female victim, but how could he have known that Liz would even be at Ron's apartment on Halloween? Once again, Liz was out of state attending Smith College at that time, and only traveled to New York on October the 29th with the intent of staying the night with a relative before spending the weekend with her family in Roslyn. We still don't know the exact reasons why Liz wound up at Ron's apartment, but how could the killers have known 2 weeks in advance that she would be there on Halloween? Even if Liz's story about staying with a relative was false, how many people knew she would go to see Ron? Furthermore, even if this snuff film did exist, there's nothing to suggest that Liz knew anything about it. If the cult was so paranoid that Ron was going to turn the film over to the authorities, why wait 2 whole weeks in order to kill him and retrieve it? How does waiting for Liz to return to New York further the plan in any way, unless they really wanted to make a symbolic gesture by committing a ritualistic murder on Halloween? But you also have to take into account that even though Ron and Liz's bodies were found on the evening of October the 31st, we can't even be certain that they were actually killed on Halloween, as the murders may have taken place a full day or two earlier. So if Berkowitz or Vinny made this entire story up, it appears they may have been too clever for their own good, as the detail about a female victim being shot in the head is not something they should have known 2 weeks beforehand. The more you dig into this snuff film conspiracy theory, the more ridiculous it becomes. A convicted bank robber named Jesse Turner would later claim that he was given the assignment of hiring the two gunmen to commit the murders and retrieve the film, but no evidence was ever found to substantiate his story. What's even more bizarre is that Turner claimed he was assigned this task by Robert Mapplethorpe, who was apparently another member of the Son of Sam cult. If you want to learn more about Mapplethorpe's background, I'd suggest checking out his Wikipedia page, but long story short, he was a very prominent New York-based photographer who generated some controversy during the 1970s when he decided to produce photographs and artwork which explored the city's gay male BDSM subculture. Mapplethorpe died of complications due to AIDS in March of 1989, but I found nothing in his background to suggest that he was involved in a satanic cult or complicit in any criminal activity, such as a double murder. The big issue with these conspiracy theories is that they can tarnish the reputations of deceased people who are no longer around to defend themselves, and that includes Ronald Sisman. Look, I'm not going to try and pretend that Ron was a saint or anything, but there's a major difference between dealing drugs from your apartment and shooting a snuff film of someone's murder. I definitely think there is some credence to the police's original theory that the murders were drug-related, though the extent of Ron's involvement in the drug scene is unclear. We do know that shortly before his death, Ron had applied for permits to obtain a gun because he feared that people were trying to break into his apartment and he likely wanted a firearm to protect himself. And if Ron was keeping drugs or cash at his place, that would make sense. The police only found small traces of white powder inside his apartment, but that could mean that there were originally much larger quantities of cocaine on the premises before the killers stole it. It's tempting to believe that this crime may have been committed by some junkies who were desperate for a fix, but if the police's theory about the shooters using silencers is correct, then this suggests something a lot more calculated and professional. Since there were no signs of any forced entry, and the apartment's front door was unlocked when the neighbors discovered the bodies, it's been speculated that Ron knew his killers and willingly let them inside. They may have shown up there under the pretense of buying drugs from him, but things then escalated into violence. I also find it particularly interesting that Ron and Liz were both wearing their coats when they were found, which suggests they were either in the midst of leaving the apartment or returning there when they crossed paths with the killers. Despite the lack of obvious forced entry, I don't discount the possibility that Ron and Liz walked inside and interrupted a robbery while it was taking place, but perhaps they originally met the killer or killers at another location, and Ron allowed them to accompany him to the apartment before they were double-crossed and murdered. Perhaps the crime was the result of some sort of drug debt that Ron had, or he was killed by rival dealers who wanted him out of the way. Whatever the motive was, I still agree with the theory that Ron was always the intended target, and Liz was an innocent victim who was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. Unfortunately, I think all the conspiracy theories involving Son of Sam and satanic cults have really muddied the waters on this case and made it more difficult to figure out what actually happened. If I had to push forward my own personal theory, I am inclined to think that the murders were somehow connected to Ron's drug dealing, and that in sharp contrast to an organized conspiracy, Ron and Liz may have been killed for the express purpose of stealing drugs from his apartment. Whoever the real killer or killers were, they probably never anticipated that their crime would somehow wind up being linked to the most infamous serial killer in the history of New York, who was already behind bars at that point. Other than the Son of Sam conspiracy theories, I do not believe there have been any credible developments in the investigation for decades, but I guess the silver lining is that these theories have helped keep the case in the spotlight and ensure that Ron and Liz are not forgotten. Hell, the fact that the murders took place on or around October the 31st has ensured that the case gets mentioned by various true crime bloggers, YouTubers, and podcasters every Halloween. So who knows, maybe this will lead to a lucky break someday and compel the right person to come forward and finally crack the case wide open. So if you happen to have any information about the murders of Ronald Sisman and Elizabeth Plattsman, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I released a bonus episode titled The Top 10 Dumbest Segments on Unsolved Mysteries, where I discussed some of the silliest so-called mysteries that were featured on the show. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the unexplained 1988 disappearance of a ship called the Freedon, which vanished during a trip through the Caribbean from Florida to Haiti. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of these commentary tracks in our archives. Also, like I mentioned in the intro, if we manage to attain our goal of reaching 500 Patreon subscribers by the end of October, we'll be providing an additional extra special bonus for our patrons in November. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Ed F., Lindsay N., Ralph C., Lauren O., and Margaret M. Thank you so much for your support. And once again, I just wanted to remind everyone that this coming Saturday, October the 21st at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be holding one of our annual Halloween-themed Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathons, in which I screen classic segments from the show, and you can watch them and chat with myself and your fellow listeners. If you'd like to join us, you can find the link to our screening room in our show notes and pinned at the top of our social media pages. Once again, it's taking place this coming Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and we hope to see you there. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, to close off the month of October, we're going to be doing a special two-part episode about a very famous murder case which just happened to take place on Halloween and has had a number of twists and turns over the past 5 decades, which have led to uncertainty about who actually committed this crime. That's right, we're going to be covering the 1975 murder of Martha Moxley. So have yourselves a great week and join us again next Wednesday for part one of this series on The Trail Went Cold.